Welcome to Close Up Radio, where our hosts Doug Llewellyn and Jim Masters engage today's top thinkers from around the world to bring you information, inspiration, and thought-provoking ideas you can put to use in your personal and professional life right now. Covering a broad range of topics, Close Up Radio digs deep to discover what makes today's top thinkers tick. Close Up Radio, where ideas matter. And now, here's today's host, Doug Llewellyn.
Well, thank you very much, everybody. Hi there. Welcome back to Close Up Talk Radio. Nice to have you with us today. We're excited because Dr. Dan Andrea is with us again. He's been a guest with us numerous times in the past, and he was here very recently with Jim having a conversation. And it really kind of focused around what all happened when COVID hit the country. Not the country, but the world. It really was pretty amazing. Everybody kind of had to adapt in one way or another. You had no choice but to navigate your way, you know, as best you could through what was going on. Some of the very rapid adjustments were much more successful than others. And as Dan pointed out, the healthcare industry adapted very quickly. Education for millions of children was irreversibly disrupted. Whatever the world is going to look at or look like after the pandemic is finally over, and we're not sure when that's going to be, it's going to be determined by organizations and institutions committed to change and the willing to take the lead. And that's where Dr. Dan Andrea comes into the picture. He's involved in many community organizations, and giving back has always been one of the biggest part of his life. He's an expert in leadership, in education, in health, neuroscience, and philanthropy. And if you ask him to describe himself, he would tell you he's an academic practitioner or a pracademic, which is a great word. I think he probably coined that himself. Anyway, pracademics focus on translating concepts into real action that make a difference in people's everyday lives. Again, to repeat that, because it's such a great description, they focus on translating concepts that people have into real action that makes a difference in everyone's everyday lives. And he has many examples he points out, but in any event, he sees his role as strengthening partnerships between organizations to ensure the road back is navigable and it is smooth. By the way, let me just point out a little bit, he is the longest-serving president of the Ontario Association of Social Workers, where he led a very successful 10-year campaign to secure legislation that recognized social work in Ontario. I should point out he is based in Ontario, in Canada. Dr. Dan may work with four or five organizations at any given time, sharing meetings with stakeholders or shareholders and organizing agendas for the outcomes, you know, that they would like to achieve. He's also been involved with the Weizmann Institute of Science located in Israel, where he serves on their international board with a neuroscience laboratory that has been named in his honor, which is quite remarkable. He has been selected as one of the most 10 leading Canadians by the Institute in Canada, receiving their Outstanding Leadership Award last year. So that's a little bit about our guest, Dr. Dan Andrea. He's based in Canada, but he comes across the border to talk to us every now and then, and it's a real delight to have him back with us today. So let's join him. He's in Ontario, where actually Toronto is where he is today. So I assume it's a – let's hope it's a lovely day in Toronto today. How about it, Dan? Is it a nice day today?
Well, Doug, first of all, it's wonderful to be with you, and I'm hoping that the dome would be open here to watch our Blue Jays play the Yankees. So actually, spring is certainly on its way. This is Canada, so we must be realistic here, but it is, for an April day, a splendid one, and I love the fact that spring is coming, followed by summer.
Oh, very good. Well, it's so nice to hear your voice again. You know, we haven't talked since before the COVID pandemic hit. I know you were speaking here
right
last week, but how did it affect you and what, you know, what you do? Because you do so many doggone things. Did it shut you down, you know, like so many others?
Well, it made a difference for sure. I mean, people refer to BC and AC, before COVID and after COVID, and we're not out of COVID yet, as you've said, but we're entering into a new phase for sure. For me, certainly when it hit in March of 2020, we didn't really know what was going to be happening. In fact, in Toronto, we were told by our public health department. This will be over by July. Just give us 3 months, and we'll be on the other side of it. And so we went, oh, boy, that's incredible. 3 months. How are we going to survive? Little did we know that our lives would be so impacted, upended. We'd become so disoriented and confused and full of uncertainty as we went along. And I think this whole situation has shown us, Doug, how strong we are, but also how vulnerable we can be in that way. So we've had to pivot along and change and adapt with resiliency several times during the last 2 years. And that's been exhausting. There have been a lot of difficulties, of course, from the tragedy of people losing loved ones, worried about their friends and colleagues, neighbors, getting ill, disruptions in work and school, as you mentioned earlier on, many, many changes. But also we've learned some strengths about ourselves and what we can do and how we can cope more effectively. So it's certainly been a mixed situation, but a difficult one overall.
Let's talk a little bit about coping. Obviously, you're a very people person. I mean, I know you work with people. You like to talk to people in person to help them, and you work with so many organizations. It's amazing what you do. I would imagine that you had to change your ways of accomplishing things quite considerably when all of a sudden, you know, you couldn't meet with people in person, and a lot of people were afraid to leave their home. Businesses, you know, people weren't going to their offices in businesses.
Yep.
I mean, there were huge changes. How did you cope personally? What did you find it like?
Well, certainly, as you mentioned, Doug, I've worked and I'm working with several organizations, and mainly in the healthcare sector, but in a broad-based way. And it really depended on the organization itself, what kind of work they do, what kind of resources they had at their disposal, how much planning they had done in advance around their priorities, because it did change for many organizations. A poll, I believe, from Austin, Texas, showed that 90% of all charities and nonprofit organizations were negatively affected by COVID. And there's such a huge range of these organizations, from the hospitals and universities that had fairly intact and continuous donations to keep them going, and endowments. But 80% of all charities are really, we could call them shoestring charities, really driven by the dedication of their staff and volunteers, and constantly trying to raise money to keep afloat. So certain organizations were more successful than others, and I would have to look at each organization, and I advise several of them to really do a scan. Hey, where are we now? What are our strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats? And what I found, Doug, was that organizations that are meeting more than the needs of one community fared better. For example, if you were involved in a certain social service aspect and you were dealing with, let's say, homelessness and poverty and health care, you did better overall than those organizations that were just focused on one aspect. So it's a question of doing an inventory, almost a needs assessment. What does the community need? How have the needs shifted as a result of COVID? And how can we meet and pivot ourselves to meet the emerging needs? Those that were more adaptable are the ones that generally have done better. And there's a wide range there, Doug.
When you say have done better, you could be talking about raising money for them or accomplishing their goal. Which are you talking about there? I mean, were they able to accomplish work and get work done? You know, is that what you mean?
Good question, Doug. It's really on two fronts there. In terms of the fundraising part, if you were an organization that depends on in-person events, walkathons, marathons, concerts, that kind of thing, it was very, very difficult because you had to suddenly pivot to perhaps online fundraising and other ways of attracting volunteers, which also suffered. Revenues went down, certainly overall. The charities that did the best in terms of meeting needs by shifting goals sometimes, or at least following through if the need was there in the community, were those involved in social services and certainly health, and I mentioned food, well, food security being one, poverty, homelessness. They did certainly very well in the beginning of COVID, but then it did drop off, the revenues did drop off as people were affected and weren't necessarily in a position to give the money they had previously given. So that was a big part of it. But in terms of the goals, it was a yes. I mean, some would shift to develop new programs. I think of an organization I'm involved with called NEDIC, the National Eating Disorder Information Center. And in fact, the needs went up tremendously during COVID as people were alone in their homes. They didn't know how to reach out necessarily or where to reach out to, but they would reach out to this organization at Toronto General Hospital here in Toronto. And so we found that the organization had to adapt to more online communication, and that was an example, developing programs in the community, doing more education, mainly over Zoom, because you couldn't bring people together in the same way you could have BC, so to speak. So that they adapted and pivoted and did very well. The Alzheimer's Society, of course, I'm also involved with. I was a former executive director there. And again, the need increased dramatically. But again, they did certainly meet needs by more Zoom, more group get-togethers, you know, over technology or through technology, and kept in touch with the communities. And they would solicit from the communities, what do you need? What can we do to help you move ahead? So they were open. The ones that succeeded the most, in my view, or the most effectively, were those that were open to listening to what the needs were and adapting to what was required at the time. And that did change over time.
Boy, it's interesting. You know, it's so interesting talking to you. You are so involved in so many different things. If someone were to ask you, what do you do? How do you respond to that? You know, simply.
Depends on the day.
Yeah, right.
I would say that throughout my career, if I look at the different aspects, I was first director of this NEDIC, of this eating disorder and disordered eating center, and then I went on to become the executive director of the Alzheimer's Society. From there, I led this 10-year campaign that you talked about for social work to get it regulated in Ontario, and the irony was Ontario was the only jurisdiction in North America without any form of any kind of regulation. So, I mean, certainly South Dakota or Mississippi or Michigan or 9 of 10 provinces here were further ahead. So that was quite a battle. And then after that, I spent 25 years teaching at university and colleges and taught, I think, 45 different subjects during my tenure there, and then became more and more involved in the philanthropic sector. So I guess sort of completing the circle here, at each different sector or time in my career, not necessarily knowing what lay ahead, I developed different sets of skills, whether they be the organizational and advocacy skills or working with government or working with strategic initiatives with organizations. So it really all came together. So I love teaching, and I think it's so important. I get great satisfaction out of that because, Doug, when you see a student or you actually see and meet with somebody in an organization, it's so important in my view to see them as a human being. I know in school, for example, when students come in, the learning and experiences don't just stop at the Adam's apple. You see a student in front of you or a volunteer in an organization or a donor or a patient, for example, working with the organization, and they come in with their hopes and their fears and their excitement and their dreams. So really to see people in that light is so important. So I would see myself, Doug, at the bottom line, as being there to encourage people, to motivate people, to link them up to services, and really try to help them along to, the word overly used is empowerment, but to let them determine what's best for them and help them achieve it.
What a remarkable career you've had. I can't help but when you say you taught, I know you taught a lot for years.
Yeah.
What did you teach? What subjects were your pet subjects to teach?
Well, Doug, they were mainly around psychology and then all kinds of psychology from, you know, personality and social and even business psychology, neuropsychology.
Mm-hmm.
But I also taught political science, leadership, humanities, bioethics. The list goes on, Doug. And each course, you know, you'd pivot somewhat. But really what you do,
sure.
And people say, how did you teach 45 courses? Well, there is a core base of knowledge that you have. And so you adapt that to whatever you're teaching. Learn some new things, but you just try to adapt what you know to the situation. I had to teach urban sociology one term. I didn't know about urban sociology per se, but I knew that there were things from psychology and sociology that could go toward making a city more effective, you know, and more people-friendly, for example. So you'd bring in those theories, but you called me a pracademic, and I'm glad you did, because I believe that knowledge is most effective when the head meets the heart, when you can take whatever theory it is and apply it directly when the rubber hits the road to make a difference in a program, in an institution, in life in general. And one of my philosophies, Doug, when I teach is really to create a zone or an atmosphere of safety in a classroom. And I find that if I can do that by respecting students and encouraging them to speak, and after a while, they'll begin to open up and blossom when they feel that trust and safety. So that's been really the lotus star, so to speak, or the thing that drives me forward in a classroom. If you treat people with respect and you listen to them, and I learn from them, they learn from me, they all learn from each other. And creating that kind of atmosphere in any organization, to me, is the key to moving it forward.
You know, you pointed out you've taught for many, many years. Are you still actively teaching, or have you kind of – go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, yeah, Doug, I'm not right at the moment. I'd love to go back and do it in other ways, do more public education, for example, which I see throughout COVID is so, so needed, and so that people can understand, ask questions and understand what's really going on so they can apply it to their own lives. You know, I shouldn't probably say this over the air, but many lectures can be at a level that is unsustainable in terms of understanding. And so people might leave and think I heard things, but I don't know how it makes sense to me. So making sense, making complicated things more understandable to me is rewarding, satisfying, so important.
You know, you mentioned COVID again. I don't want to get totally off of that subject. Let me just ask
sure.
you, do you feel there have been any positive things that have happened as a result of the pandemic and what we've been through?
Yeah, it's a really good question, Doug. And first of all, I have to say that everybody listening to us today has been affected by COVID to greater or lesser degrees. And everybody has reacted differently based on their personality, their conditioning, their genetics, their circumstances. So everybody is going to interpret things according to their own perspective, absolutely. What's positive? If I look to organizations and people in general, I think mm-hmm. there's a much greater respect for health and understanding that it's more fragile in many ways than we used to think. And here we were facing a microscopic virus we couldn't see. It was a battle of a different kind. So I think people are more aware of health issues. Also, the importance of people, you know, and relationships. And we get so much into our own lives that we sometimes don't pay attention or enough to those people around us. We need people. We are, Doug, hardwired psychologically and biologically for connection with people. It's just simply part of our heritage. And when we don't have that, we suffer. I think one of the biggest problems with COVID is that of loneliness and thinking of seniors in nursing homes or people who just didn't go out or couldn't get out, and how the anxiety and depression and other feelings coming out of that were detrimental for sure. But back to the coping strategy, I think it's allowed people to analyze their priorities in life. What's really important? And I know people that have shifted jobs or decided to go into business for themselves because they wanted to work at home. They found that that was a good thing and a positive thing for their families and for their own mental health. Other people love to get back to work, so everybody here is unique. So I think it's allowed us to look at our priorities, our values. It's allowed us to appreciate more life, and those are some of the good things. And certainly in businesses and nonprofits, learning to use digital technology more effectively. Some didn't like it, but everybody did adapt to it. It's certainly changed the way that people go around fundraising. And even, it's really interesting, in terms of looking at coming back to offices, which is happening, and looking at how they can make the office more people-friendly in terms of the colors painted on the walls or offering certain programs in the charity in terms of relaxation programs, et cetera. So I think there's a greater awareness, and I hope it lasts, in terms of how we can become more customer-user friendly.
Well, it certainly has made a lot of changes. I really haven't thought about them in the context of positive changes. But, you know, when you talk about it, a lot of people who have had to have work at home have found that they like working at home and they don't want to go back to the office. And the executives and the businesses have realized this. And they're now, you know, adapting their schedules to make people be able to work at home periodically, you know, in the future. You know, 2 or 3 days at home and then come into the office 1 or 2 days. Everybody's changing, but that's been something quite amazing, I think. Anyway, let me ask you something else.
Yeah, sure.
Your background and the things you've been involved with, what prompted you to have such an interest in eating disorder that you became, you know, heavily involved in the National Eating Disorder Information Center in Toronto?
That was many years ago. And in fact, you know, people might say, you know, Dan, Dr. Dan, you may well have had your life all mapped out. And not at all. Life is about taking advantage of opportunities. Some of it's luck, for sure. When it comes to eating disorders, I was actually working at the time, if I can say this for a politician, actually, doing work, community work. And I wanted to change at that point in time. That's a whole other talk with you. But anyway, I went out to a mall many years ago. I parked my car and I wanted to think, what would I like to do? And so I went to the newspaper box. I put a dime in the box. That's how long ago it was, Doug, a dime. Got a paper out, opened up the want ads, went down the pages of want ads, and saw a tiny one. It was maybe a quarter of an inch, no more than half an inch thick. It said, organization looking for researcher in eating disorders. And I thought, well, I have a degree in psychology and social work. I knew a little bit about it, but I was no expert. But long story short, I applied for it. I was fortunate enough to get it. And then the director, who was ready to retire, did step aside maybe a year later, and I became the director at that point and got more and more involved in it. So in terms of serendipity, in terms of the luck of the draw, that's how that worked. But it's a fascinating area. The need is increasing tremendously. These are people suffering from disordered eating, whether it be anorexia nervosa, bulimia. There are several other kinds as well. And the goal is to help them and connect them up to resources, get them the medical help they need, because actually eating disorders have the highest mortality rate of any psychiatric or psychological illness, and that surprises people too as well. Many, many different causes for it. Part of it is societal in terms of the expectations for beauty, for example, but I must point out that many more men now are also developing eating disorders to live up to certain expectations that way. But it's not just a question of, I don't want to eat. There are several psychological factors going on there underneath, and they need to be addressed. And so I found it fascinating. It included psychology, sociology, biology, neuroscience, a lot of different interests that I had. And so I went on to stay in touch with them. I then became chair of their advisory committee about 5 years ago, served my term, have been a donor to them, and I'm a senior advisor to them still. And I'm excited what they're doing now in terms of expanding their programs, educationally, going into schools, getting kids when they're young, and addressing some of the challenges that lie there.
Well, boy, when you get involved, you really do get involved, no question about it. And also, I know you were the first executive director of the Alzheimer's Society. We don't hear enough about that, you know, that disease.
Yeah.
You know what?
You want, wait, Doug,
obviously, I know you still care deeply about that. What's the latest on Alzheimer's? Are you still involved with them, by the way?
I am. I'm on their. I chaired their patrons council a few years ago. I'm still on their patrons advisory board that way. And really, I got involved in 1986, so it's a long time ago now. And where does it stand? There still is no cure for Alzheimer's disease, and that is tragic. There are drugs to deal with certain symptoms, but ultimately it is a question of decline, you know, of the nervous system of the brain, and they haven't really come across anything that has come close to a cure, if I can be very, very open with you on that. They're looking at cause and effect. It used to be thought that there were plaques and tangles in the brain, and these caused problems among the neurons that connect up with each other, and that was causing the problem. Now they're not sure whether that's a cause or an effect. We could put 10 scientists in here, and they all might have different interpretations. Does stress play a role? It's been a big part of what I've been involved in, too. Does stress play a role? Is it diet? Is it toxins in the environment? Is it genetic? You know, certainly we didn't have Alzheimer's 100 years ago very much because we didn't live all that long. I think 45, 47 years of age at the turn of the last century was our life expectancy. Now it's up to the 80s, 90s, and beyond, so a disease of aging as well. So there's still a lot more work to do, and in the whole area of neurological diseases, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and other ones too, Doug.
Did people understand what Alzheimer's was, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, 40 years ago?
Not really. In fact, I was working at Natick at the time, and somebody suggested to me, a good friend said, you know, you ought to do an evening with the Alzheimer's Society, because Natick also put on conversational evenings at the main reference library in Toronto here. And I said, honestly, totally honestly, Doug, I said, what's Alzheimer's? And how do you spell it? I didn't know. But I got on the phone and I asked to speak to their director to set up an evening where we could have a public education experience. And they said, we don't have a director. We're looking for a director. And so I said, really? And I read up more about it and I thought, this sounds like a real challenge. And it's a tsunami of the future. And I was fortunate enough, Doug, to get the position. And then at that point, we were really, at that point, honestly, a kitchen table organization. A lot of terrific, dedicated volunteers, but it really needed to advance to the next level of professionalism. So it was a wonderful challenge, but we set up a counseling center, a resource center. We expanded the support groups that were needed. Public education was a big part of it, too, as well, working with allied professionals and the hospitals. And fundraising as well. And I ran a radio show there for 4 years as well in Toronto and talking
what
about
happened
the
to
issues.
That? Goodness gracious.
My God. Okay.
All right, listen, we have a minute left. What's next for Dr. Dan Andre? How would you answer that?
Well, a good question. I think that what I've done, you know, in terms of helping people and offering advice, et cetera, will always be there. Other causes may come into it, but I would like to do more public education for sure, maybe do some more writing. I do focus a lot, we didn't talk about it today, Doug, but have previously, on stress and the importance of stress in our lives and avoiding burnout, for example, but how to deal with stress, which we all have in our lives. You can't escape that fact. But there are ways to mitigate it, to take control of your life in that regard, which has benefits down the road.
That's a subject for another conversation, Dr. Dan.
Please
we
do, Doc. I
run out
to.
Of time. Our guest
okay,
is
well,
Dr. Dan Andre. He's based in Toronto. Let me give you a quick email if you want to get in touch with him. Write it down real quick. aleonachase@simpatico.ca. aleonachase@simpatico.ca. Dan, I wish we had more time. You are one great guest. Thank you, sir, so much.
You're a great interviewer. Thank you, Doug. Take care.
From Close Up Radio, a division of Close Up Television Incorporated. For more information about our show and to be considered for future broadcasts, please visit closeuptelevision.com. You may also learn about us on social media and listen to us on podcast and internet radio. Thank you for joining us, and we hope that you have an empowered and productive day.
Boy, do we ever. I'm Doug Llewellyn. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. Till then, take care. Bye for now.